Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, some clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. I'm Jeremy Mags. A very warm welcome. Coming up on the program today, a 360 million rand SAPS tender scandal exposes how procurement systems are manipulated. Experts push biometric solutions to shut down a SIM swap fraud loophole. South Africa wastes billions in food while hunger continues to rise. And a farming succession crisis puts livelihoods and food security at risk. It's Friday, the 27th of March. Now, I think the real question in the wake of the SAPS 360 million rand tender controversy is not just who may have been involved, but how a procurement system can be bent badly enough for a scandal of this scale to happen. For an independent forensic view on where controls fail and how organizations respond, I'm going to introduce you to our guest in just a moment. But first, a little bit of background. The National Police Commissioner, Fani Masemola, is facing charges over a health tender awarded to companies linked to the tycoon Vusimusi Katmatlala. The contract allegedly marred by fraud, fronting and kickbacks, and it's led to the arrest of 16 people, including senior police officials. So let's explore this in a little more detail. Elani Fuchel is with me, Senior Forensic Manager at Loxton Forensics. Elani, a very warm welcome to you. So let's look at principles if we can. How does procurement corruption usually start?
Thank you, Jeremy. So the most common issue is usually relationships between suppliers and insiders. For example, a supplier may get inside information before the tender is advertised, giving them an unfair head start. Or during the evaluation process, officials may ignore missing or invalid documents, influence others on the committee, or they push the bid through using a so-called emergency or deviation. In cases like the Medicare 24 tender, where there were allegedly glaring blunders in the bid documents, it suggests that multiple people likely worked together to push this through.
Are there common warning signs, early warning signs, that something is wrong?
So some red flags are quite subtle but important. So these are undisclosed relationships or conflicts of interest, a specific supplier being strongly pushed by an official in the procurement department or even in a business unit. Urgent or emergency tenders, these are quite high-risk ones. Highly technical tenders where few people understand the details are also at risk. This is, for example, software tenders. And then we also see vague bid specifications in the initial bid that's published, and then these are later changed after the contract is awarded. A key issue here is that corrupt relationships are often deliberately hidden, making them quite hard to detect with basic checks.
I think that's the point I want to raise. Why do you think these red flags so often go unnoticed? Because you talk about the subtlety.
Yes, Jeremy. So they are, as I've said, corrupt relationships, they are deliberately hidden and deliberately obscured. And often in public sector, I mean, their resources are quite limited. In the private sector, where there are systems to deal with this, people are often the ones that you need to worry about. Your procurement officials and people in business are usually not properly trained to address these red flags or to see this at an early stage, and it's only at a later stage when contracts are signed where these red flags are maybe picked up by the internal audit department or by external investigators. But by that time, the organization has already suffered financial prejudice.
And as an investigator then, Elani, what would you be looking for immediately?
So a solid investigation comes down to skills, process and fairness. So investigators in forensic investigations must really understand the law of evidence. And what I mean by this is they must know how to gather and preserve evidence properly. Witness interviews must be structured and well-timed, and there must be strong internal audit support. Another consideration is that labor law must also be followed to ensure that the process is fair and outcomes are legally defensible. And if this is not done properly, cases can collapse even where misconduct exists.
And that's a long and complicated list. It's difficult, what I'm hearing you say, I think it's difficult to build then a forensic case that can actually stand up in court.
Correct.
So how often do they fail at the last hurdle?
So usually it is, this is in an ideal world. All of these requirements must be present for a forensic investigation to stand up. But it is unfortunately in companies or in the public sector where they are limited resources and they do not want to spend thousands of rands on external forensic investigators. The internal audit departments or internal officials usually deal with the initial steps of the investigation. And this is usually where gaps come and where evidence are not properly preserved. And this can really derail the entire process. And we see this happen quite often. So that is why we often suggest preventative forensics. So putting in place all the measures to prevent this from happening rather than trying to figure it out after the damage has been done.
And Ilani, I think that's a key phrase, preventative forensics, because I would suggest to you that in spite of best intentions, many organizations are simply kidding themselves or fooling themselves about how strong their controls really are.
Exactly. So organizations, there are practical steps that they can take to implement the so-called preventative forensics or preventative measures to prevent these from happening. So firstly, we would recommend the most important aspect is to strengthen your people and processes by doing proper background checks on your procurement staff and to train your employees to spot fraud risks and red flags. Secondly, to also use technology. So to move away from paper-based tenders, and we see this quite often in the public sector, they still rely a lot on paper tenders, and to implement electronic systems with audit trails, as well as combining that with data analytics to detect patterns. Lastly, we recommend tightening controls. So this would include the normal controls like separation of duties, closely monitoring deviations and emergency procurement, and also independent review before any approvals. So the reality is good systems definitely don't eliminate corruption or risk, but they make it much harder to hide.
Thank you very much indeed. In conversation there with Ilani Vogel, Senior Forensic Manager at Loxton Forensics.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, South Africa is losing billions of rand to SIM swap fraud every year, raising urgent questions about whether SIM registration rules are simply too weak for a digital banking age. To discuss then how this fraud works, why existing safeguards are failing, and whether biometric SIM registration could in fact help close the gap, I'm joined by Johan van Graan, who is a telecoms security expert, former chief risk officer at Vodacom. Johan, a very warm welcome to you. Maybe just a quick primer for us, a quick background here. How does SIM swap fraud usually work in practice? What's happening here?
Jeremy, thank you. SIM swap fraud is the enabler that the criminals use to intercept one-time password to take over a social media account. The actual fraud is by accessing the internet banking where they have previously phished this PIN and password of a customer, sending WhatsApp messages to say, I need money, please send money. So the SIM swap fraud is where the SIM is fraudulently swapped, but the actual fraud takes place outside the telecoms network.
And Johan, why is this then such an effective crime in South Africa?
It's because we are gullible. We give away our PINs and passwords. We want to invest. We enable the criminals to be able to get our personal information. And with how the RICA Act is written at the moment, for networks, telecom networks, it's very difficult to, when a SIM swap is requested, to validate that it's the actual customer, user, owner of that cell phone number that's doing the SIM swap. And that's why I'm advocating to change the RICA Act for biometric recognition to be included at time of registration. I propose face recognition because that works in the banking sector for FICA. And then when a SIM swap does take place, the networks must use that facial recognition to validate the SIM swap. So this will stop the fraudulent SIM swap, and it should vastly reduce internet banking fraud, social media account takeover fraud. It won't stop it 100%, but it will reduce it.
How big a weakness, and I want to get to the facial recognition in just a moment, but how big a weakness is the current RICA process then? And why are existing checks not stopping criminals? Where's the flaw here?
The flaw is, maybe if one can say, the RICA Act is twofold. The interception portion, with the previous changes a few years back on journalists and lawyers, it's most probably in the top five in the world. But the customer registration portion is in the bottom five in the world. What the Act asks, Mr. Customer, walk up to a RICA agent. The RICA agent looks at the ID presented, looks at your face, freehand capture the name, the ID number or passport number, the address. There's no validation of the information. No copy of the IDs are kept. None of that information is kept. The networks have tried for postpaid customers, because they do credit vetting. They can get that information and they use it. And they are currently using facial or other biometric recognition. But a big problem, 80% of our customers in South Africa is prepaid. So there is no effective validation for the when there's a SIM swap.
Johan, do you think biometric SIM registration would actually change the game or just make things a little bit harder?
I think it's a total game changer. It's not that it will make it harder. It will definitely change it dramatically. The so-called pre-RICA SIMs most probably will disappear to a large extent, specifically if one also changed the Act to say a South African ID may only have 10 cell phone numbers, a passport number may only have one. The networks have the technology to enforce it. So pre-RICA SIMs will stop. And it will also, because the biometrics is needed at time of SIM swap, it will definitely, I would say 99% reduce SIM swap fraud.
Is the technology to do this already widely available?
Yes, it's already widely available. Banks use it extensively. Other people use it extensively. All the network operators use it for postpaid customers. In their apps, they have self-RICA or RICA friend. It works. It's there. The problem is that by law, you can't compel a customer to give a copy for a RICA registration specifically for prepaid.
Where do you think the logjam then is in implementing a system like this? Would it be with the regulator? Would it be with the networks themselves? Or would there be customer pushback?
I think it's with the regulator. When we were greylisted on the FATF, this was one of the instances that were identified. I was personally present in a meeting with the then Minister of Justice, Ronald Lamola, where he has asked the networks to come up with a solution through ACT. The networks has done it, has proposed it to government. I just think the logjam is that it's lying somewhere in the legislature change process. It's not important enough, or there's not persons that can rewrite the Act. So I think it's there. Networks will welcome it because I think it will reduce the so-called washing machine effect, where 60% of their prepaid SIM cards are recycled every year. There may be pushback from customers, but I think the genuine normal customer, there won't be a pushback. And specifically, just take people, and there's about 300,000-400,000 of them every month whose phones get stolen. They want to get their life back. For them, just to do a SIM swap, they go to a network operator or on the smartphone via app. You take a photo of the live person and they swim. They've done a SIM swap and they get their SIM back and their life back.
Just a final question and a brief answer. The telecom operators themselves, is it unfair to say that they might be partly responsible for either leaving or not identifying this loophole open for so long?
It's very difficult to say that it, I would say yes, the first 10, 15 years, most probably of the RICLA Act that's promulgated in 2002, everything went fine. But then with the digital economy that started, fraud has taken place. And SIM swaps is the enabler. But then the operators can't change the act, can't force hand over ID, can't force compulsory SIM swap validation via biometric.
Thank you very much indeed, Johan van Graan, telecoms security expert, the former chief risk officer at Vodacom.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, this is worrying. South Africa is throwing away millions of tons of food every year, even as hunger and food insecurity continue to rise. It's a real contradiction that I think raises serious questions about inefficiencies in the food system, corporate sustainability and accountability, and whether policy failure is allowing waste to persist at scale. I want to discuss this in a little more detail now. I'm in conversation with Dr. Lisa Barkley, Senior Lecturer in Future Studies and Systems Thinking at the Stellenbosch Business School. Dr. Barkley, a very warm welcome to you. Let's start with that contradiction. How does a country with widespread hunger end up wasting so much food?
Well, that is generally because of the systemic issue. We're a massive country. So everything is so dispersed. You have shops that have a lot of fruit and vegetables that go off, and then they have to get rid of it. Now, some of the shops do have systems to get it to the poor, but not all of them do, especially not the smaller ones. And then, of course, it ends up in our households. And we buy new food. There's a little sad yogurt or a little sad tomato that keeps being pushed to the end of the fridge, and then we throw it in the bin and forget about it. That then ends up in the landfill where it rots, and then that gives us methane, and which is a climate situation as well as carbon dioxide. So it's such a systemic issue that it's not something that you can solve very easily because we are a country that is poor. So we don't have a government with infinite money that can come and say, oh, well, we'll solve the problem, like we do see in some of the Scandinavian countries that's also relatively urbanized and small countries.
So talking about solving the problem then, where does the focus need to be? Is it on production, distribution, the retail supply chain, or just the way in which we consume?
That should theoretically be on all of them. But as consumers, we do not always have the power to manage what is being farmed. And we go through fads as people. So sometimes strawberries is all the rage, and sometimes it's kale. And every recipe suddenly have something within that, and there's a big demand for it. So that side of the demand side and what the farmers actually then eventually put in the land, that we do not have that much control over. But on our side, there is quite a lot we can do as consumers to minimize our food waste and actually use the food waste in intelligent and interesting ways.
It's all very well to have the list of how we should do it, but I guess the bigger question is whether we can facilitate or affect a mindset that is going to encourage that kind of behavior change that that you're advocating for.
That is a big one. That is why if media and the influencers and people that have some impact in schools can actually start doing it, eventually will become a habit. And we see quite a lot of people that when they adopt the zero waste lifestyle, find that it saves them a tremendous amount of money because they don't have constantly replaced food. You can actually grow food from leftovers. You can make extended meals from what you were going to throw away. But absolutely, it's a mindset change, and it's just something that people have to adopt. But people do say it, they don't know what they have to do or they're too tired, but eventually it does save a lot of money.
Is this a regulatory issue? Do we need to change the way in which the law is constructed, which would perhaps encourage food redistribution, better use, or even donation? Or is it up to individuals, do you think?
Well, one could ask the law to do more, but the law and the people that actually have to conduct the investigations and the fines, and that they, I think they're already exhausted. So if we as society can take it upon us on grassroots level, we will make a much bigger impact than waiting for policies and legislation to pass at parliamentary level.
Dr. Barclay, you talk about the importance of individuals taking this particular bull by the horns, but is there also a sense that a lot of that waste happens before the food reaches consumers? And perhaps we should be talking a little bit more about that. In other words, more efficiency within the supply chain.
Yes, there is definitely, if there is holdups in terms of traffic situations, there is going to be quite a big wastage possibly from the farmers or the markets to the suppliers if we do go into a severe oil crisis where we will see a lot of spoilage. But generally, there is at the shops as well, the various and restaurants. But as I say, some of them do actually already have systems to give their surplus over. But quite a lot of the smaller ones, smaller restaurants, smaller businesses also have a massive wastage on their side as well.
And I'm also assuming that maybe it's even a political or a philosophical issue where maybe supply chains traditionally are optimized for profit and not efficiency or even social need, as you're suggesting.
Yes, absolutely. And it also it started haphazardly. It wasn't as if everybody decided, well, this is the system we're going to develop. It is just how the system ended up being. But we can make incremental changes and basically ask our shops, well, what do you do with your waste? On our side, we can try to do more. But a lot of places are moving towards a circular lifestyle, circular design, where the waste goes back into the farmers' markets, especially if people have to do their own composting and they donate it to the small community farmers' market and then buy their food from those markets. Then we tend to have a more circular system. Some of our bigger shops are working towards a circular system. But for now, it is still a very linear system that ends up in the waste bin and ends up in the sea and ends up in our land.
So what's
decomposing?
Final question then. What's the one big thing, Dr. Barclay, that you'd like to change that might take the momentum from incremental to something a little bit more meaningful?
The first thing is definitely awareness. We live very unconscious lives that are on automatic, that we do things, and we used to, and our parents used to do it, and everybody around us do not really consider that little spoiled strawberry or blue strawberry we quickly discard. We don't really think about that. And it's at the moment, environmental concerns is not front of mind. We go through phases and we are in a down phase. But people have to just consider that and look for alternatives in terms of their lifestyle. Have a little compost bin and grow their own vegetables. So think before they buy. Do a couple of small things that will not only make an impact on their pocket in their storage in their house, but also in the environment in which we eventually have to live in.
I guess, as you're rightly suggesting, solving this problem does begin at home. Dr. Lisa Barclay, thank you very much indeed. Senior Lecturer, Future Studies, Systems Thinking at Stellenbosch Business School.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, let's end the program with this. When a farmer dies, it's not just a family tragedy, obviously. It can become an economic crisis overnight. Let me explain. In South Africa, where fewer than 15% of people have a valid will, the death of a farm owner can trigger forced sales, legal disputes, and even the collapse of a multi-generational agricultural business. And it obviously raises serious questions about succession planning, financial preparedness, and whether the country is possibly putting one of its most critical sectors at unnecessary risk. Someone who's applied his mind to that is Frikkie van Lochrenberg, who is Chief Executive Officer of IFSA Asset Managers. Frikkie, welcome. Let's start bluntly. How often does a farm actually fail or get sold off because there was no proper succession planning?
Jeremy, you'd be surprised how many times that happens. And we've picked it up the last couple of years that it happens more and more. Now, normally what happens, it's not a complete fail of the business, of the farm itself. That's been generationally built up over 20, 30, 40 years. There is a specific angle that you can take out of a financial perspective that they've got the property, the land is worth a heck of a lot of money. You've got your implements, your equipment, and then you've got your livestock or your input costs. Now, what happens is sometimes when the planning doesn't work or there is a problem with the planning, they have to sell off one of those three things, and you actually need it as a unit to make everything operational and make it work and sustainable. So it puts pressure on the system, and we not total and utter fails, but there is a lot of unnecessary pressure on the system.
You say that fewer than 15% of South Africans have valid wills. That in itself, Ricky, is a problem. But is the farming sector any better, do you think, or might we be sitting on a bigger systemic risk?
Jeremy, I believe that there is an issue, that there's an emotional connotation to doing a proper planning when it comes to these things. And then there's the out of sight, out of mind type of thing, where the farmers are already under pressure when it comes to the agricultural sector, the prices and so forth, that they just don't put time aside to focus and go through an exercise and make sure that everything is in place. So in the farming sector specifically, the agricultural sector, you will find typically that there is a will, but the whole system or the whole structure is not properly structured, and that leaves something to be desired. And another thing that we've actually picked up, which is very interesting, is that capital gains only started to be implemented here in 2003, 2004, whereby planning that you've done post that 10 years or whatever the case, the capital gain wasn't that big of an impact because you've got a base cost of when the capital gain started. It's only now the last 5 or 6 years where we actually see the property prices is booming, and when there is transfers to be done or sell-offs or there is this inheritance issues, then you actually see what the capital gains impact is on the estate.
Worst case scenario, of course, is the Intestate Succession Act kicks in, and that could effectively destroy the economic viability of a farm for some time, and potentially it would have an impact on food security.
100%. Jeremy, you've hit it spot on there. Interstate, it's not the common thing that you think that the state is going to take your farm away, going to take all your implements away because there's no will. There's specific ways and that out of a legal perspective, the estate is handled. But it's a to put you into the light. A couple of weeks ago, we had a specific scenario where there was an issue with the will, and it couldn't be implemented, and they had to go interstate. So they've got their three brothers. Two of them stay in Australia. Now, all of a sudden, everything is split between the three brothers, and the one brother is the one that actually does the farming. He's actually the guy that does the work. So at the end of the day, that puts a massive amount of pressure on the specific system. And if it's not properly looked at, properly structured, you lose generational wealth and you lose that effectiveness of the sector.
There's another layer to it as well, is that workers and communities tied to a farm, when succession goes wrong, are also impacted. So it could be a social risk and not just, I assume, a financial one.
100%. If you take a look at the employment, how many people the agricultural sector actually employs, and if there is this constant issue, this constant negative whereby it's not market related, it's not business related, there is prices, there is production happening, but something at the back end goes wrong and there's a transfer of value or not a transfer of value, and then all these people sit without work, even if it's temporary, but it's still a physical, a massive impact on the social economic being.
What about banks and financiers themselves? Do you think they adequately factor succession risk into how they lend to farming businesses?
In my view, Jeremy, we've got a very, very good banking sector, specifically when it comes to credit risk. The guys, they don't take chances, and they want to make sure that if there's a facility or there is a bond in place, that they ask the questions and make sure that, there is some structure in place that can initially, specifically, make sure that everything goes like according to plan, and there's no risk on the banking sector when it comes to, these types of things, because it's not a it's isolated. It's not a blanket type of coverage. But the important thing is that the responsibility sits with the business, with the farmer, to make sure that it's as everything grows, as the liability grows, as everything progresses, that there's a constant check, a constant revaluation on the structure, making sure that all the boxes are ticked and what you actually want to happen with your inheritance actually happens. And by doing that, you make sure that your social economic risk is mitigated, but so risk at a financial point of view is mitigated, and then also your children or whoever takes over the farm is actually taken care of, and that generational wealth can just build forward.
So I wonder if South Africa is, as you've just heard, underestimating a slow-moving crisis in agricultural succession, and if not dealt with, could have real economic consequences. It is an important issue. Frikkie van Lochrenberg, thank you very much indeed. He is the Chief Executive Officer of IFSA Asset Managers. And that is our program for today, and in fact for the week. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.